Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Stuart Patrick, who is a senior fellow and director of the Program on International Institutions and Global Governance at the Council of Foreign Relations. His new book is The Best Laid Plans, The Origins of American Multilateralism and the Dawn of the Cold War. Stuart, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in New York City and spent the first 3 years of my life in Paris. But ever since then, I was basically raised in suburban Maryland right outside of Washington, D.C.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
It's particularly my father, I would say. He was an international tax attorney, and not that I was necessarily enamored of international tax, but when I was a child, he negotiated tax treaties all over the world, and he was gone, which was for a lot of the time, which was too bad, but he would come back with all sorts of curios from different parts of the world, Indonesia or Africa, parts of Kenya, etc. And I think from the time I was very young, I sort of looked at life as almost a sort of life as National Geographic magazine in some ways. And so I became very interested in international topics at a quite young age.
And was there discussion of international politics at the dinner table, or just the stories of his trips and the hard work of negotiating?
It was probably more the stories of his trips. And actually, he was, in some ways, it was more the romantic aspects of things and the day or two trips off the side of these negotiations to the Okavango Delta or a place like that. But there was also, a great value placed by both my parents on public service. And my father always looked back fondly, even when he was back in private practice, on the days that he had spent as the most rewarding ones when he was actually in the policymaking arena.
Mm-hmm. And where did you do your undergraduate work?
I was out here in the Bay Area at Stanford. Actually, my undergraduate degree was in human biology, studying human evolution, but I got a BA from Stanford and then went on to graduate school.
And then graduate school you did in England, and you were a Rhodes Scholar.
That's correct. Yeah, I spent about 4 years in Oxford and got a couple of master's degrees, and then started my doctoral dissertation, which I finished in 1996.
And what was your dissertation on?
It was on a subject very closely related to this. It was on U.S. plans for the post-war era, that is the second, following on to the Second World War, and in particular a focus on U.S.-French relations, I think perhaps hearkening back to the fact that we had lived in France and my family was Francophiles, and looking at how the U.S. managed its leadership with a sometimes very fractious and difficult ally in the part of the French.
Mm-hmm. And with your degree, were you then a social scientist, a historian, and then how did you become a policy wonk, which I guess is what
right,
you already...
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
All of the above.
And that's a compliment, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Okay. Yeah.
It's interesting. The degree was really one, and partly because this is the British system, it's much less... an effort to turn social science into natural science, as it is often in many of the departments in the United States, which have methodologically gotten really involved in sort of quantitative approaches and econometric approaches to these topics. There, the study of international relations is really much more about diplomatic history and cultural studies, mm-hmm. and political philosophy. So that was something that appealed to me very much. When I came back, I got a job at the Center on International Cooperation at New York University, and I spent 5 years there. And that again has some relevance to what I'm doing now. It was the center was set up to really look at how do we improve the management of international institutions and provision of global public goods amongst different countries.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious now, looking back at your own career, what you can tell us about what these different disciplines, political science, history, have to offer as you kind of navigate this world of policy? I mean, what skills do you think you need to do the kind of work you're doing in this book, which we will talk about in a minute?
Sure. I think you need to have a certain appreciation for the histories of the different countries that are involved in either any negotiation or any effort to create a reasonable structure of world order in which countries can resolve their common their differences and take advantage of their common interests. And I think that this. I think the United States is in a sense, less an innocent abroad than it used to be in this regard. But I think sometimes policymakers don't approach international problems with enough of an effort to see things through the eyes of others.
Mm-hmm. And is that something, by the way, that you got from your father? Because if he was negotiating tax law treaties, I guess you to reach that common good in a tax treaty, you really have to localisms.
Yeah, I think so. Also, my undergraduate degree, when I was studying human evolution, I did a lot of anthropology as well, which discussed the difficulties, really, of in a sense trying to put on the spectacles of somebody else in another culture. The other thing that I will say is I ended up partly. As a policy wonk, the fact that from 2002 to 2005, I was in the Secretary of State's policy planning staff at the State Department when Colin Powell was Secretary of State, at a time when there was tremendous controversy about what the U.S. role in the world should be, in particular what its attitude towards multilateral institutions should be. And I have to say that it took me about 6 months, once I had entered the building from an academic background, not to be a danger to myself and others, because there are aspects of the policymaking process that we don't read about in the books when we learn about them in the ivory tower. So it was a real eye-opening experience for me.
And what did you learn without, you know, asking? I'm not asking you to do insider gossip here, but what was it? It was. Well, the first thing that comes to mind, was it about saying, well, that isn't the lesson of history with regard to this particular thing? That isn't exactly the way we did that when we did it somewhere else?
Yeah, I think the two things that were the most eye-opening for me when I was at the State Department were, first of all, the power and often blinding power of ideology. And this wasn't necessarily always, this isn't necessarily common on the State Department during that era, but of aspects, in my view, of aspects of the Bush administration's foreign policy was the degree to which a certain moral certainty and love of ideas or particular ideas could sometimes blind policymakers to the complexity of the real world. The other thing, which is true in any administration, is the tremendous power of bureaucratic politics to actually govern what the outcome of foreign policy is. And, you know, there's a cliche that where you stand depends on where you sit. But until you have actually seen the unedifying a portrait of sausage being made within what they call the interagency process, you really will not believe the degree to which that's true.
And that must be terribly frustrating for somebody who actually can see ideas in their context, but also can see them in the context of history.
Yeah, I think that there are, you know, when you see nuance and shades of gray, particularly if you're working in an administration that, in a sense, doesn't do nuance, it can be extremely frustrating. And I think that one of the experiences of one of the lessons of the recent experiences in U.S. foreign policy is the need to get back to a more realistic and pragmatic approach to foreign policy, which takes into account some of the things that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. So when and let me show your book again, The Best Laid Plans. And really, it's a book about ideas and American leadership in the period 1940 to 1950, when we built a set of multilateral institutions. So, what did the book emerge out of your dissertation? I mean, it's obviously much broader than that. But tell us how you conceived the idea of the book and how long it took you to do it.
Sure. It did emerge initially out of it's probably about 10% of it is from my dissertation. But you know, at the end of the Cold War, when I was really starting graduate school, I was fascinated by this what seemed to be a fertile moment. Not so much the end of history, but perhaps the return of it in terms of, you know, after the certainties of the Cold War suddenly seemed to disappear, and the question would be, what logic of world order would take its place? And there was a tremendous, as you recall, a tremendous upsurge in enthusiasm for the United Nations, mm-hmm. a sense that finally now the organization could live up to some of the aspirations of its founders. And, you know, by the mid-1990s, I think there was a certain amount of disillusionment with that and a certain amount of return to a more sober attitude. But ever since the end of the Cold War, there have been these debates over, well, what now? Containment is no longer the governing rationale for U.S. foreign policy. Should we revert to more of an isolationist pose? Should we try to continue to build international institutions and invest in them? Or should we adopt perhaps more of a selective great power internationalism? And all of these things, as I began to read, had occurred earlier in U.S. Foreign policy. And this particular era, people look back sometimes with two rose-colored glasses, but as one where the United States really took the bull by the horns and laid the foundations at the height of its power for the enduring international institutions.
And as you do this, let's look at some of the problems. I mean, this was a unique situation, this 1940 to 1950, but it's very clear that there were three pillars to this multilateral international order that we came to build both, from the period 1940 to 90. What were the three elements of that in security and economics and in self-determination, actually?
Yeah. As a result of some of the lessons of the Great Depression, but also as a result of some of the components of U.S. political culture. Once the United States is in a position, in a sense having arrived on the world stage, the question is what principles is it going to use? And the Roosevelt administration, I think, was preoccupied with a sense of the failures of 1918, 1919, and the Paris Peace Conference and the Versailles Settlement. And there was a sense that the United States had won the war but failed to win the peace. And so during quite early—
That was after World War
I. Excuse me, yeah, after World War I,
yeah.
Right. And so and I think that there was a real— there was, after a retreat into isolationism, sort of toward the end of the 1930s, there was a sense that, especially after war broke out, but even before Pearl Harbor, the Roosevelt administration suddenly became very preoccupied with what are going to be the pillars of the post-war order? And there were three, as you mentioned. One of them was a modified form of collective security. There was a sense that Wilson had overreached with the League of Nations, trusting too much into pure collective security. And the idea here was that, you know, we need to have a post-war international organization, but we need to vest power much more strongly in the hands of the great powers. And so you get the plans for the UN Security Council, and which vests, obviously, power in its permanent members. So that's one of the pillars. A second recognition was that the international economy had really deteriorated, and actually part of the slide into war and the deterioration of the political climate during the 1930s was directly related to the sort of terrible inward-looking beggar thy neighbor policies that many countries had adopted during the Great Depression,
and including Roosevelt.
Indeed. Early yet, sabotaging the London Economic mm-hmm. Conference. We obviously just had another one with the G20, yeah. which perhaps we'll talk about later. But during the Hoover administration as well, with the Smoot-Hawley tariff, and, you know, global trade collapsing from $50 billion mm-hmm. a year to $15 billion a year, et cetera, over the course of 3 years. So under the leadership of Cordell Hull, who's a sometimes maligned Secretary of State, but the longest-serving Secretary of State in American history, the United States began a reciprocal trade agreements effort to try to lay the foundations for a post-war system of non-discriminatory international trade and payments. And that ultimately resulted in the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade. And then the third component, which I associate with as an integral to U.S. liberal internationalism, is support for political self-determination And this was the notion that one of the reasons for global violence and instability, and also for discrimination in economic terms, and also just an unjust element of world order, was the persistence of European colonial empires. And so there's a very strong element of this liberal internationalist vision which calls for the self-determination winding up of the European colonial empires. And this is visible in the Atlantic Charter of 1940 in a number of statements during the Second World War. And the rest of the book, in a sense, that's the beginning of the book. The rest of the book is what the heck happens when the Cold War suddenly breaks out, and what happens to this vision.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a student of international politics, I know you look for explanations of why America did the extraordinary things that it did in setting in place these institutions, because sometimes they really appeared to go against self-interest. You point out, rightly, I think, that what America did was distinctive, and had there been a different hegemon, different things could have happened. But traditionally, an IR analyst, an international relations specialist, would say, well, this was about the distribution of power in the world, that really America had all the chips, basically, and that's why you did it. You move beyond that, but respond to that way of looking at this. Sure. And why that's not an adequate explanation.
Sure. And I think that this is, within, as you point out, within the discipline of international relations, there the mainstream theorists, sometimes called neorealist or neoliberal institutionalists, mm-hmm. as well, would suggest that that there are so-called rational choice reasons for why the United States, given its power position and given its long-term interests, would have adopted multilateralism as a framework for world order. The difficulty with those sorts of explanations, there are a number of difficulties, but the big one is it presupposes that no matter who had been, what country had been in the U.S. shoes, we would have gone in this direction. And I think if you indulge in a few counterfactual thought experiments about how things might have been different, it's not simply that if Nazi Germany had won the Second World War, things would have looked a lot different. Tribute state relationships, much more interventionist economic policies, unequal bilateral relationships. Certainly would have been the case if the Soviet Union had emerged as the most powerful country. But even if Britain had, things would have been different. It would have been a far less institutionalized international order. So I start looking for some other explanations that could complement some of the insights that traditionalists have talked about. And one of the main factors that I point to is American political culture, and particularly the liberal exceptionalism that Lockean liberalism that in a sense defines American political culture and sets it apart from most other countries. And in a nutshell, that exceptionalist tradition portrays the values governing the American political economy, the legal values, political values, economic values, as ones that are inherently superior, but also potentially universal. And so it's this sort of notion of the United States as a city on a hill, et cetera. And so my argument is really that given these tremendous opportunities to remake world order, there was an inbuilt tendency on the part of the United States to try to do it in its own image. And so in a sense, I see multilateralism as a projection of American legal and political values to the world, to try to one historian has described it as to trying to Lockeanize a hitherto Hobbesian world. And that's one of the two explanations that I give. The other explanation, which has to do more about timing, is why this precise timing has to do with new ideas and the lessons of recent history. I think that there was a real conventional wisdom arose by the end of the 1930s that some of the policies that had been pursued during the interwar period by the United States were tremendously destructive, and that. The preconditions for peace and stability and economic prosperity really required a turn towards multilateral institutions.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to break this apart, because once we understand what you're saying, and your argument is quite powerful, and our audience really has to read your book, because there's an enormous amount of...
And they can even purchase it.
Yeah, definitely. Buy it, I'm sure, at Amazon.com.
Right, I'm sure it's available.
Yeah. There's a rich detail which becomes very important, but I want to use that detail to have you sort of explain to us how this happens. And I guess what I wrote down in my notes is there's a process here, and I want to walk through that process and try to understand what it is that makes this happen. I mean, clearly we have a political culture, and it's there, and it's the ideas in our heads about how we relate to the world. In fact, when I was reading your book, I pulled out my Max Weber, and he says, his essays in sociology, not ideas, but material and ideal interests directly govern men's conduct. Yet very frequently, the world images that have been created by ideas have, like switchmen, determined the tracks along which action has been pushed by the dynamic of interest, which is, I think, what you're demonstrating here. So the first element, it would seem to me, is leadership. And the men, first Roosevelt, but then also the men who in his government who had this experience that you just talked about in their mind. I mean, can you give us any reference point here, a particular individual who really becomes very influential in making this happen? Because a set of ideas in this period that you're describing emerges based on this war and depression experience.
Yeah, I think definitely I can give you a couple of ideas, and I think that's a very well, by the way, that the Weber quote is, I think, is really appropriate. Because the argument, in a sense, is that both U.S. National identity and also new ideas end up channeling and influencing how people actually understand their national interests. And cataclysms like the Great Depression, like the slide into the Second World War, like the overwhelming disappointment that the United States, in a sense, had missed the boat at the end of the First World War, give rise to a situation where new ideas can be extraordinarily influential, and they can drive the creation of new institutions. It's very clear in the chapter, the two chapters really on economic thinking, that Cordell Hull had a tremendous influence on how certainly the State Department came to terms with the economic requirements of peace. There's actually a chapter here which deals very much with Hull that's entitled "When Goods Move, Soldiers Don't," mm-hmm. which really reflects his belief that not only was multilateralism a recipe for economic prosperity, but it was essential for world peace, mm-hmm. Because otherwise countries would use alternative means to try to secure the goods that, in a sense, Hull says they could have gotten through peaceful exchange. So he is certainly a major example of that. Dean Acheson as well emerges in both the pre-Cold War and Cold War eras as someone who has emerged from this experience as a sober-minded and I would say hard-headed liberal internationalist. He's very dismissive, as other people like George Kennan are, of empty legalisms. But on the other hand, he's wise enough, and has an enlightened sense of America's self-interest enough to realize that that institutions are an enormously important way of embedding the United States, first of all, in the world order, so it won't go back to isolationism, but also of winning legitimacy for America's purposes abroad. Another person who I might mention is Harry Dexter White, who, as you know, was the main negotiator with John Maynard Keynes in what became the Bretton Woods institutions. And he's fascinating in that he really epitomizes the notion that this is not simply a return to 19th century free trade in terms of the global economy. It's a world economic order that is largely open, but it's predicated on domestic intervention. And the message that comes through loud and clear from White and from his colleagues is that world prosperity is too important to be left in invisible hands. And and this is something that I think in our own era has a certain amount of resonance.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that strikes me as really important that emerges, you see these names of Republicans, Wendell Willkie, John Dewey, so and then later Vandenberg. That is, Republicans on the other side of the aisle from the Democrats who are in power in the White House, buying into these arguments. How do you think that happened? And was it what you've already said, just the experience of the war and the Depression were so powerful? Or was it Roosevelt and Hull and Acheson's leadership?
I think the latter more. This was not an accident that there was a bipartisan framework for American global engagement that was forged during this time period. And a lot of it was really, again, a reflection on the lessons of Wilson. Disastrous experiences in Paris and then in his attempt to win U.S. approval for the League of Nations. There really was a strong sense that that Wilson's stubbornness and unwillingness to compromise and failure to include, for instance, significant Republicans in the Paris Peace Conference had undermined his efforts. And so you see this during in early plans for Dumbarton Oaks and the laying the blueprints for the United Nations. Hull is very conscious and conscientious in making sure that Republicans are included in that. Mm. Same with the San Francisco Conference on the founding of the United Nations. The most dramatic episode of this bipartisanship occurs in sort of the later end of 1944 when Governor Dewey of New York, who's the Republican standard bearer during that year, starts to make some statements that he really mistrusts where Roosevelt is going in terms of the post-war international organization, worries about all sorts of secret agreements that are being reached. And Hull reaches out to John Foster Dulles, Dewey's emissary, and they together negotiate to keep out of the 1944 presidential election the very question of whether or not the United States should enter the post-war United Nations, which in the current environment is just almost inconceivable to think that you could actually, abstract that from domestic politics. So, one can exaggerate during this time the notion that politics stops at the water's edge. I mean, certainly Mr. Republican Senator Taft of Ohio is routinely calling, the International Monetary Fund pouring money down a rat hole the first time that expression shows up. So there are real problems, but the cultivation of Senator Vandenberg, who I think after he says 1941, Pearl Harbor, ended isolationism for any realist. Mm-hmm. But there's an effort to cultivate him when the North Atlantic Treaty is being, with the Vandenberg Resolution to ensure that there's not the same sort of objections that there were over Article 10 of the League of Nations with respect to the NATO.
And what is important about these processes, it would seem, is that because if you have American identity and American political culture, it has to turn in a way, because everything that you said about the city on the hill, the example, I mean, there's a conflict here. There is the idea the world should copy us, which it says, let the world fight its wars, will stay out, will be isolated. So what this process and is doing is turning the culture sort of in the water to avoid the iceberg, I guess you would say, and to say, let's engage the world. And that's why this is really unbelievable.
Yeah, I think that you're onto something in your comments there, that that the tradition of American exceptionalism is by and large accepted across the American political spectrum, which is fascinating. And the three traditions that I identified that had emerged by the early part of the 20th century for U.S. foreign policy all accept American exceptionalism. There are the isolationists who, in a sense, believe that America is so exceptional that it could only be contaminated by other countries or get itself into trouble if it engages in intervention elsewhere. There are the great power internationalists along the lines of Teddy Roosevelt who believe that the United States is a righteous power, but it's a power. And if anything, its multilateralism should be along the lines of a concert of great powers, but it should pursue a very geopolitically sober course. And then there are the liberal internationalists who are best embodied in the earlier era by Wilson, who believe that it's America's duty to have a world under law. So the challenge for Roosevelt and the challenge for any president, I would say, is to try to invoke and have their actions resonate with the tradition of American exceptionalism, but to put it in the service of building a better, safer world that reflects American ideals. And that can be very challenging because it requires you to make deals both domestically and internationally. And playing this two-level game is extremely challenging.
Mm-hmm. And then the other element that we have to add here is the emergence of the Cold War at the end of this period, where America has to step back a little from its universalism and focus on building up the economy of Europe and creating NATO.
That's absolutely right. And I think in many people's mind, there's a real sort of sense of divorce between U.S. policy from 1940 to 1946, 47, and then what happens later and spans the next more than four decades of the Cold War. What I suggest is that there is tremendous continuity between those two periods. I have a quote from Charles Bolin, the U.S. Very accomplished U.S. diplomat from 1947, that says basically, in short, there are two worlds instead of one. And coming to grips with that reality and the fact that that the Soviet Union is not willing to accept this open world concept, which the United States has been going forward with, that leaves a quandary for American decision makers and American strategists. Do they abandon that vision, or do they do something else? And they do something else. They try to marshal that open world vision in the service of a more circumscribed free world community. It's not one world, as Wendell Willkie had hoped in 1942 when he made his famous round the world journey, but it's a free world. And so the multilateral institutions become, the shield and the spear of U.S. foreign policy. And you see transformations in the economic realm and in the security realm.
Let's go back to the origins of your book and not to the origins of the multilateral world, because you were in graduate school. You get interested in this founding period, and so it is this period of the following Clinton administration, and then the Bush administration, where you just told us you served, where a comparable set of problems emerge, really. And I think it's very important to talk about those two periods, and then as an entree point to talking about the present economic crisis, because in a way we're really it's the same set of problems again. And so in a way, Clinton was looking around. I think your colleagues, Gold Geiger and Cholet, in their book say that they even brought Acheson to Washington to ask him, well, what should be the grand strategy? And so talk a little about that, because we wind up not building a new set of institutions, it appears, or adapting the institutions we had in a way that followed through on the new world?
Yeah, I think that early on, and even with going back to George H.W. Bush's administration with the invocation of the notion of a quote-unquote new world order, there is an effort to some degree to, it's somewhat desultory, but to try to create new institutions. So you get, for instance, the creation of the World Trade Organization, et cetera. And to some degree, the Clinton administration's doctrine of engagement and enlargement of countries from the former Soviet Union, et cetera, Europe whole and free, et cetera. These are efforts to try to, in a modest way, try to expand the existing Western institutions that have served so well during the Cold War. I think that that there was often during the Clinton administration less forthright American leadership than there might have been. Early on in the Clinton administration, it's somewhat forgotten now, there was the so-called Tarnoff Doctrine, which was from Peter Tarnoff's comments that the United States really didn't have, even if it had the will, it didn't have the way anymore, and that we needed to have sort of a joint sharing of responsibilities. I think that that there was a little bit of a vacuum of power in terms of and a vacuum of leadership during parts of the Clinton administration. I think later on, by the end of the second term of the Clinton administration, I think that the United States, the administration, had come to realize that nobody else was really there to pick up the baton. What's distinctive about the Bush administration, I think, the George W. Bush administration, was really that, in my mind, it represents a relatively qualitative break with several decades of tradition of American foreign policy. I don't think it was only unilateralist, and we can discuss that. I think it had an alternative conception of multilateralism in part. But there was a certain in-your-face quality and a certain relish in the first couple of years of the Bush administration in terms of abrogating or pulling out of a number of different multilateral frameworks from climate change to the International Criminal Court, et cetera. And I think that there was a real sense that most multilateral institutions were real drags on the United States' freedom of action, potentially infringements on its domestic sovereignty in some cases, and that other countries were, in a sense, using international institutions to tie down Gulliver. And I think that the country was feeling its oats, and particularly after after 9/11, the United States, in retrospect, I believe, missed an opportunity, partly because it didn't recognize the importance of legitimacy in the broadest sense, international legitimacy in helping the United States get things done, and it undervalued some of the capabilities that one gets with standing international institutions.
And you point out that the beauty of this earlier period when the multilateral world was created with the institutions was that America had a sense of its self-restraint, basically, that it could see the virtue of building international institutions that where it maybe gave a little more than it necessarily had to out of self-interest, but in the long term, it created a set of institutions that we would gain from. But in this period after the fall of the Berlin Wall, let's look at the configuration of power. And I guess what you had is two views of the world, that a multipolar world was emerging on the one hand, or that America was number one and nobody could restrain us. And so part of this story, I guess, is about coming to terms to what the real balance of power is in the world.
Yes, it's interesting to look back at that era because particularly right at the beginning of the Clinton administration, there was a sense of you know, the United States, in a sense, is the weary titan, and it's the economy stupid, et cetera. And it was really about looking inward, and that the United States wasn't really willing to bear some of these burdens anymore. I think, in retrospect, this was, of course, the beginning of a tremendous boom in the U.S. Economy, and by the end of the decade, of course, the French were complaining, as is their occasional wont, about the United States as a hyperpower, and there were invocations by Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, which seemed quaint in a sense in retrospect, that the United States was the world's indispensable power, which stands taller and sees farther than others do. Again, I'm not sure that one can could make that claim with a lot of credibility today after the incredible tumult of the last decade. One of the things that the experience of the last 20 years suggests is that it's hard sometimes to get an accurate read of how powerful countries are actually relative to one another, and it's also dangerous to project what the world's going to look like in 10 or 20 years on the basis of current trajectories. Now, for instance, you have, I think the conventional wisdom is that China is going to overtake the United States, certainly in the size of its economy within the next 20, 25 years, but there are all sorts of things that could happen between now and then.
And one important difference, it strikes me, between both the Clinton era and the Bush era is the lack of consensus among the American political parties about how to engage the world. Which really became a source of the different kinds of irresponsibility that Clinton and Bush evinced. I think Clinton's irresponsibility, I will assert, and you can argue with it, that it involved what you were referring to earlier, let the market do it.
Yes,
you don't need regulation, and you can do it globally. And then, of course, you've already discussed the irresponsibility of Bush.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. On the in the case of Clinton, there was really a sense that we'll just ride this crest of globalization. In a sense, we don't have to take advantage of this momentary this holiday from history, if you will, to try to lay the foundations for more effective institutions, particularly on the security front. And so, I think in retrospect, the Clinton administration relied too much on the market, as you say, and didn't pay enough attention to some of the geopolitical trends and didn't use that moment of prosperity to invest in international institutions. The breakdown of bipartisan comity on is to some degree understandable because the Cold War, of course, could unite liberals and it could unite conservatives. And the disappearance of this common entity this common adversary did deprive, in the same way that it deprives the West of, in a sense, glue and solidarity, it also deprives the American polity of a similar sort of glue that could justify long-term investments in some of these institutions. But the level of partisanship, by the mid-1990s, with respect to how the United States should engage the world is quite dramatic, and that certainly carries over into the Bush administration. I think 9/11 is also tremendously important in how the Bush administration decides to engage the world. And there is a sense that in an age of transnational terrorism and of potentially catastrophic threats that can come without warning, that it's unwise and would be an abdication of responsibility for U.S. statesmen to leave U.S. security in the hands of organizations that are often as hamstrung as the U.N. Security Council.
Mm-hmm. But it was in both cases kind of a fascination and an acceptance of America's unbridled power. I mean, Clinton didn't evidence it in the military realm so much as he did in the financial, for example, the 1990s financial crisis.
Sure.
And of course, with Bush, it's quite obvious. Now, we now have an economic collapse, basically, or near, maybe I shouldn't go that far and just say a severe economic crisis. And so the question, it's very clear now that this is a much more multipolar world in the economic realm. So let's look at your analysis. And I, as I read your book and we're experiencing the G20 meeting, it sort of struck me that when we get these people together now and there isn't the preeminent power, that there's a lot of this national political culture and national identity that's coming to the fore and explains the lack of agreement. Is that a fair use of your book?
Yeah, I think that in part, yes. I think that when one looks at the challenges of sort of world order making or remaking in the time of this global financial crisis, there are some major differences between the eras that make it all that much more difficult for the Obama administration and indeed the United States as still the world's preeminent power in trying to forge a new order or try to sponsor a new order. And one of them is there's a couple of issues here. One of them is, in relative terms, the United States is not nearly as powerful as it was at the end of the Second World War when it, you know, bestrode the world like a colossus, as the saying went. You have a situation where it's gone from the world's leading creditor country to the world's greatest debtor country, and where it's balanced economically by the European Union, and it's dependent on the Chinese to maintain the role of the dollar as a major reserve currency around the world. So it's on the ropes a bit economically, but it's also it lacks the sort of ideological leadership that it enjoyed during that era as well.
Ideological leadership in the world?
The world. And then what I mean by that is that, you know, the financial crisis has really hit at the American model of capitalism. It's hit at the so-called Washington consensus about the idea of that reasonably free markets will be able to deliver prosperity. And I think, in a way, it maybe gets us back to the original model, which emerged from the Great Depression, which was this notion that I mentioned earlier that global prosperity is too important to leave in invisible hands. I think after the Reagan-Thatcher revolution of the 1980s, there was a real sense of removal of restraints, removal of regulation that got away from some of these earlier norms that guided a sort of a managed form of global capitalism for a number of decades quite successfully. Another thing that's very difficult is that we're faced with a challenge here of trying to adapt international institutions to tremendous changes in the global distribution of power to accommodate the rise of powers, particularly in Asia. But unlike the architects in the 1940s, we don't have a blank slate. We have what my friend and colleague Dan Dresner of Tufts University calls an unclean slate. And it's hard enough to create institutions out of whole cloth. It's so much more challenging to try to redistribute power within those institutions. Take the International Monetary Fund. There's a lot of talk about we need to give the Asians more weight in it. But there's going to be a lot of oxen gored if that occurs. So the Belgians will say, wait a second, you're going to try to dilute our power. Now, it's only Belgium, but it's part of the European Union, and they'll object. So trying to reapportion these things and to try to adjust is very difficult. Same thing happens with the UN Security Council. You're not going to see France and Great Britain, as many people think they should, consolidate their one Security Council seat into a common EU seat. So there are major structural obstacles towards global reform.
And in this context, it's as if the U.S. has tried to apply Band-Aids so that, for example, the failure to reorganize the IMF prior to the 1990s financial crisis led to this glut of savings that account for at least partially the collapse that we've recently experienced. And then in the case of NATO, the whole effort to enlarge NATO into essentially beyond the goals that originally had has created problems with Russia, and now we're seeing NATO reaching to the problem of creating stability in the Pakistan-Afghanistan.
That's right. I think that NATO, there's a chapter in the book which talks about the creation of NATO and the fact, interestingly, that the United States took a multilateral approach towards Western security. Now, you know, NATO's current difficulties are sort of an ironic outcome of its tremendous success. I mean, if one had asked Acheson, and people indeed asked Acheson if NATO was going to last for decades, and he said no. He thought that it would be a temporary institution, and of course NATO exists. We still have many troops in Europe, etc. But at the end of the Cold War, there was a sentiment that NATO had to go out of area or out of business. And as you point out, the danger now is that having gone out of area, it may in fact go out of business. Mm-hmm. And it's been some of the debates that have been at the core of NATO from the beginning are really accentuated in Afghanistan. And part of it relates to burden sharing. And it also relates to threat perception. All alliances, all collective defense institutions require some degree of common perception of threat. And it's not clear that, given wavering public opinion in many of these different countries, that that the Germans, for instance, see the dangers of the Taliban taking over Afghanistan in the same way that the Americans do. And, you know, there's a tendency continual tendency to free ride on the back of American military power. Mm-hmm. And so even those of us who are in favor of multilateral institutions and alliances are aware that that stimulating collective action with other countries still often requires the United States to bear the heaviest burden in terms of maintaining the vitality of these institutions.
One of the things that strikes me is that the fact that the Soviet Union fell without war and that there was no economic depression or crisis until the present did not give us one element of the structure that you've identified with regard to seeing that if it wasn't a question of building new institutions, it was really adapting them to new tasks.
Yes. One of the lessons of the book is that major institutional change is far more likely to happen in the aftermath of cataclysms. In the absence of a major catastrophe and demonstrable policy failure, you're more likely to get what a biologist, I guess, would call phyletic gradualism rather than a punctuated equilibrium. You're not going to get this dramatic quantum shift. You're going to get you're going to get sort of more discrete changes at the margins. And I think that that's what happened with the Cold War ending without a shot fired, without NATO firing a shot, led to incremental solutions. And it may be that that this is inevitable. Now, the current crisis, one of the major questions about the current crisis is how serious is it? And it may be serious enough to have some more significant changes in some international institutions. Just in the G20 meetings this week, for instance, you saw a major ramping up of resources for the International Monetary Fund. What you have not yet seen are major changes in the governance structure and the weighted voting. Mm-hmm.
In the IMF.
But if one begins to see, you know, on the other hand, you're seeing the Chinese, for instance. You know, they're feeling their strength a little bit because they've been hit a lot less, and the currency imbalance that you noted between the United States and China in particular has provided a certain leverage. And you have the Chinese even beginning to question the enduring aspect of the dollar as a global reserve currency. So you're beginning to see some signs of a shift towards a more multipolar order, and that multipolar order actually being reflected in global institutions.
Let's assume that President Obama takes his key figures in foreign policy and international economics to Camp David and says, "Read your book." That is, read Patrick's book.
We should all aspire to this.
Yeah, but what for our leaders and also for the general public? What are the elements that one should draw from the book, understanding that we're dealing with a different historical epoch? There's a limit to what you can take from history. So how do we distill lessons here that would be important as we manage a very different world?
I would point to two or three lessons that I think are ones that could be generalized to the current order. And the first of these is just the importance of investing in international institutions, and in some cases, paying the upfront costs to ensure institutions survive into the long term, particularly if one can imagine your power dwindling in the future. The time to lock that in is now. The second issue is the importance of forging and attempting to forge some bipartisan consensus. Now, you're never going to get the extremes, whether you're Republican or Democrat. You're never going to get the other side's extremes going along. What you want is to give enough ground so that you can have, in particular, Congress engaged in a responsible form of U.S. global engagement. And there are always going to be debates. But cultivating those alliances, not simply taking the partisan path, is very important because even if you control Congress now, you won't probably throughout the entire time of your tenure in administration, in off-year elections, et cetera. The other side will normally make up some significant ground, and you will come to rue having ignored them. And the third major element is to be willing to, at the international level, to be willing to adapt and adjust in terms of the precise details of the international institution or global bargain that you're working on in return for something whose broad contours meet your interests. The United States throughout the Cold War showed a certain magnanimity and self-restraint and a willingness to occasionally bear an extra disproportionate cost of global public goods. But in the end, there was something enduring and predictable that increased the legitimacy of American power.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that the final analysis also, public education is going to be very important for especially the president as he navigates both the international and the domestic arena, and he's going to have to build coalitions in both places.
That's absolutely correct. One of the on the domestic front, I think, as I've pointed out, American exceptionalism is a major theme in U.S. Political culture. And that can be exploited to justify a rather narrow-minded view of what America's interests are in the world. And I think it's incumbent upon this president or any president to remind the American people, and it's not just terrorism, but it's in so many different ways that, and the financial crisis has underlined this as well, that we are part of an increasingly interdependent global system. And it's not... The priority for us should be to ensure that to the degree that there are international institutions that can help manage that, that they bear the stamp of the United States in large part, and that some of the fears about American sovereignty, which, and believe me, running a program on international institutions and global governance, I get some colorful emails from some people who have spent a lot of time listening to talk radio, worried about American sovereignty, that many of those are, in practical terms, overblown, and that provided that there are reasonable safeguards on American freedom of action and sovereignty, that that international institutions are a way often of extending American power and American influence in the world, because otherwise the record shows we can't accomplish much for our own interests going it alone.
Well, on that note, Stuart, I want to thank you very much for being here. Let me show you your book again, The Best Laid Plans. I think it's an important read to understand where we are now and to understand how now is different than it was in the period 1940 to 50. Thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so
and
much.
Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.